Hello, my name is Ella Layton, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. April Baker Bell about her book, Linguistic Justice, Black Language, Literacy, Identity, and Pedagogy. Thank you so much for sitting down with me for this conversation. We're very excited for your presentation tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So my first question is, what personally drove you to the study of Black language and linguistics, and was it initially an interest of race and social justice or just language in general? And can you describe how your ethnographic project came to be?
That's a good layered question, so I'm going to try to answer it in layers. So I would say, you know, when I think back about my experiences with language, I realize that I've just been a lover of Black language for a long time. You know, before I even got into the work, like growing up in the city of Detroit, I always say, you know, Black language was just, you know, it was the language, you know, of the space. Like it was the universal language, it's what we spoke. And so I just love the way Black people would use language. You know, it was just like always interesting. Like I feel, you know, the type of rhetorical strategies, especially that were used to describe various things. So I've always had a love for language, which also showed up in the way that I love to write and how I love to write, you know, how I saw language as intersecting with culture. I just really loved language. However, you know, I was, so when I wanted to teach, I wanted to be an English teacher. And I think it was part because of my love for language, my love for writing. But I would say when I came at language from more of a joy space. I think that's why I wanted to be a teacher, because of the joys I, for the most part, experienced with language, you know, how I saw language, and so I wanted to teach English. But the, I would say the political nature of language education came into play when I started teaching in the city of Detroit. And there was a moment where we were just talking about language, and, you know, the curriculum talks about, you know, students have to be able to communicate in standard English. And so for me, I wanted to talk to young people about, like, my students' standard English being this kind of, you know, vehicle that, like, everybody use, you know, to connect with. Like, people have a home language or a different way of speaking, but this you know, like, idea of standard English was this vehicle for each person to connect on. And it was in that moment where the students weren't buying it, you know, and I recall a student saying, you know, what I look like speaking like that? It don't even sound right. And I remember other students started to, like, you know, push on that, like, well, but how you gonna go somewhere talking ghetto? You ain't gonna be able to get a job. All of these kind of conversations that I think we have culturally, but that we also see, like, the ways in which we think about how people can use language. And in that moment as a teacher, I didn't feel I was trained to address these critical linguistic issues that the students were raising. And I felt ill-prepared as a teacher. Like, culturally, I knew that they were speaking the truth from my perspective. I'm like, they're right, you know, about having these conversations. Students were saying things like, it sounds like we're talking white. The standard English feels like, you know, the way white people talk. It doesn't feel like this vehicle that you're describing that's inclusive of everyone. And they were right. And so that was the beginning of my journey of being able to, like, think about language from a critical lens, and to think specifically about English education from a critical lens. I would say, as I talk about in the book, it was my students, you know, that really gave me that critical side to understand that there is a dilemma here in the way that we're teaching and the way that students understand their language and how it works in the world. When, like, you asked the question about, like, how the ethnographic aspect of my work. So when I started this work, I was thinking about it more so just from a practical standpoint than, like, what are the approaches? How do we address this in classrooms? And any teacher, the first book you might come across is, like, Rebecca Wheeler's and Rachel Swartz's Code Switching book. And while that book felt very practical in terms of a way of, like, talking about language, there was something always that didn't sit right with me with the book. And it was, I think from a cultural standpoint, my cultural competence, it just didn't sit right. It didn't seem fair. And the more I grew into the work, you know, I kept that in mind. And so the ethnographic part of my work, I became really interested in, like, how students were, you know, there's so much push around what they should do with their language, how they should speak, whether it's code switching, code meshing. But I was concerned with how they're experiencing the curriculum, because whenever I would try to get to this point of talking about language or how we should use language, how we should instruct around language, there was always, like, resistance or pushback, or, like, you know, this real internalization around it. And I wanted to get to that. So I wanted to question young people, how you experience your curriculum? You know, how do you experience your language instruction? How do you experience navigating your language, not only in school, but in the world and in your communities? What do you feel, you know, like educators should be thinking about? And so that's what led to the ethnographic aspect of my work, where I became less, you know, concerned about like the pedagogical approaches or implications, but what do they feel? Because that matters, right? And so that's when Leadership Academy, that I talk about in Linguistic Justice, is only one of the spaces that I did ethnographic work in. But my work pretty much has always existed in a Detroit or a Metro Detroit type of context, where I'm talking to Black students, Black teachers about their experiences with curriculum. And like out of that, like ethnographic research is what grew, that's what Linguistic Justice grew out of. It's not about teaching students to change their language. It's not about fixing students to accommodate these very broken and problematic systems, you know, that have always existed. It's about how can we better these systems where all students, and particularly in these cases, Black students and other marginalized students, can come into a space and their linguistic gifts and their culture can be seen as intellectually valuable, you know? And so like that's what Linguistic Justice grew out of and continues to grow out of. It's like, how do we listen to people about how they're experiencing the very thing that we are suggesting or imposing on them?
Thank you. I really liked your answer about focusing on experience of Black students and teachers. It's a very Black or like Afrocentric way of thinking, focusing on experience first rather than always prioritizing data or research, even though that's important. Yeah. It's not the center of everything. So to continue off of that, for people that don't believe a Black language exists or Black language just a dialect, why is it important to make that distinction that Black language isn't just a deviation of white mainstream English? And how do you establish that it's its own independent language or convince others of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the ideologies that we see that exist around, you know, Black language comes out of, I think, a few different spaces. One of those spaces is a lack of knowledge about language in general. Like, what is a language in the first place? What is a dialect? And what I found, even I didn't have those twos. I took two linguistic classes. Maybe I did have these twos, but it was never applied to Black language specifically. So I took linguistic courses and they'll talk about like a language being qualifying as a language if it has syntax, you know, semantics, phonology, and these certain type of like features. And so I think that many people think that Black language is just slang, right? And you can't reduce a whole language into slang, you know. And so when I came across the work and understanding that Black language is a language in its own right because it has these features, that did something. It shifted something in me, you know, in terms of how we understand language. You know, like I've always valued it, but it helped me to value it in this very scientific way. I think understanding that scientific side of it, I think people who are, I guess, really open and willing to learn, it could help them situate Black language in a totally different context. However, I think that people who outright resist it as a language, even with what science tell us, even with linguists, what they tell us, you know, even with like the experiences we have in the world and what we see, I think that that is a larger representation just of how people see Black people. You know what I'm saying? And some parts of it gets to where we don't see, you know, Black people as fully human, you know what I mean? Or I think that when it comes to language, the challenge is like, what would it mean if we can say that Black people are bilingual or multilingual? That shifts some stuff up, right? And I don't think people are ready or comfortable to think about it in this way. So I think like a larger part of it is, you know, just what people believe about Black people and Blackness in general. But I do believe for educators, you know, if you are walking out of a teacher education program, you should be able to understand what constitutes a language, you know, like you should be able to understand a history of the language, able to understand the cultural impact, you know. And so I think that that's important. For me, I see my work as bringing together these worlds, you know, like of like linguistic research, historical, you know, research, education, you know, and like pedagogy. It's bringing this conversation, I think, I don't want to say full circle, but I feel like these have existed in silos, you know, and for me, it's bringing everything together so we could fully understand Black language across all of these different spaces, you know, and connecting, you know, Black language to the Black experience and Black humanity.
I do resonate with that. I think the fact that you use the term like anti-Black linguistic racism situates this issue of linguistic injustice into a larger conversation, which I believe makes people struggle with those differences.
Mm-hmm.
So with teaching this pedagogy, the anti-racist Black language pedagogy, in your book you teach it to kids at Leadership Academy. How would you think you would go about, or other educators go about, implementing this pedagogy for Black adults, particularly who already have like these formed prejudice ideas about identity mm-hmm. and language? And then how do we collectively across races in America break this way of thinking and move towards an anti-racist Black language pedagogy?
Yeah, so I'm going to start with the first part of the question in terms of thinking about Black adults who've been socialized into understanding language and education in a certain kind of way, who not everyone, but like some of us who've been kind of socialized and conditioned under respectability, politics, and pedagogies, right, in terms of how we exist. I think that this work is ultimately is decolonial work, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like decolonial pedagogy. And I think like to get to people who have been conditioned and socialized a certain way, we have to undo that work. And for me, what that has meant is when you start talking to folks, I think it's just like with the young people, you know, it's like, let's deeply think about the intersections between, you know, language and identity. I feel like we don't really deeply have those, you know, conversations about what are the intersections? How does, you know, language represent identity? The anti-racist Black language pedagogy, I talk about like these, like, you know, five or six type of artifacts that I deal with the young people, but I've done this not only with young people, I've done this with adults. But so one is language and identity. The second is, you know, thinking about the intersections between language and a people's culture. And thinking about another one is language and history. And I think that that language and history is key because we just think that Black people are, you know, speaking, they can't speak, they speak in a broken version of English, so to speak, or that they, you know, they can't communicate, you know, in this particular way without understanding like history. You know, like history plays an instrumental role in how Black language came to be what it is today. Like we don't want to talk about language planning, right? Like that happened, you know, before the transatlantic slave trade. Like that was an important component for me to learn. It's like how language planning was very instrumental in that we intentionally, you know, split up enslaved Africans based on their language, where we did not put them in the same groups of someone who communicated in their same language because they would have been able to break free. And, you know, they wouldn't be able to rebel, you know, and so that was like intentional. And so when I went to Ghana this summer, I went into one of the slave dungeons, and that's exactly what they talked about. Like that was instrumental. And so when we think about that history, and in spite of like that history that, you know, enslaved Africans still created, you know, this now language that we call Ebonics or Black American English, and there's many variations all around the globe, right? That it grows out of that like historical context, right? And that it's a resilient language, you know, and that, you know, even with them developing this, they developed this language in spite of coming to a country when there were laws, literacy laws, where they couldn't read, they couldn't write and do all of these things. And this language has still sustained itself. And I think that like that's one aspect of it, but we don't think about like the survival technologies that are embedded in that language. Like that's so important. Like I think that shifts things. I see a shift in Black elders, you know, Black young people when they learn about that history. But then how do we take all of these things? So like some of the young people would say, well, then why isn't our language accepted then? Like if all of these things exist, it's a history. We're seeing the grammatical and rhetorical features. We know it relates to our culture and our identity, but we're often told we don't have a culture. We don't have a language, right? You know, why is it treated this way? And then that's a natural conversation where we begin to talk about anti-Black racism and how language connects to that anti-Black linguistic racism. You know, so we begin to talk about these different things and then like, well, what can we do? You know what I mean? What power do we have to kind of transform these things that exist? I think that that's a shift that I see no matter who the learner is or what age, because we've only been given this one narrative about our language, so we understand that narrative. Because without this historical context, without the linguistic context, right, it seems like, why are Black people speaking this way, right? So I feel like the anti-racist Black language pedagogy gives this full picture. It's what I talk about as a Black linguistic consciousness raising type of thing. In order for us to value this language, I feel like that consciousness raising has to happen. If it doesn't happen, we're not going to be able to value the language.
Continuing talking about reception of your book, particularly after the publication of Linguistic Justice, you received many hateful and threatening messages. Could you talk about the type of people and audience this was from? Why do you think your research in pedagogy ignited such intense and negative emotions? And also, if you could talk about how this was received by the academic community, particularly other scholars in writing center studies and such.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. I think, I think that when my book was published, it came out in May 2020. I feel it was 1 week after George Floyd was unfortunately murdered, by a police officer. And so there was a lot of tension, I think, in that moment. There was a lot of tension where people really saw this moment as this is us, this is who we are, as a nation, and we want to do better. So we know there were a lot of racial justice protests happening everywhere around the country. At the same time, there were people calling out police brutality. There was a lot happening. And at the same time, there were other groups who were, the police aren't like this. This is not reflective of everyone. It's there was also a rise in the racism and the hate. And so one of the things that happened, in 2020, the summer, right after George Floyd and after my book came out, the college, the Conference on College Composition and Communication reached out to me to head up a statement. And it was we titled it, This Ain't Another Statement. And they were Black language demands. And so the history of this field is that, they've always stood on the right side of history for language rights. There's always been resolutions, position statements that the Conference on College Composition, and Communication has stood on. So they wanted one this particular moment in history. And so we wrote these Black language demands. Some of it was informed, of course, by how we were thinking about linguistic justice, but I did it alongside other Black language scholars. And that particular statement, separate from linguistic justice, really became a source of hate. And it also became a source of this is what is happening in these universities that are indoctrinating students. They are indoctrinating students to hate white people, and they are indoctrinating students to, everybody have to learn, they need to learn Ebonics. And that's exactly not what was happening. So it was an intentional misinterpretation of what we were doing, and I think that misinterpretation by people who understood that it was a misinterpretation, these watchdog places and conservative journals, I think that they intentionally, twist what we were saying. And I think so much of the pushback really came from the misinterpretation of what we were doing. So I can't necessarily say that people were in an uproar because of the very things that we were standing on. It was more so an uproar of these places that were misinterpreting our demands, the purpose of linguistic justice. So I would say most, from my understanding, most of the hate and what I've seen came out of those particular places. So I would say a lot of the, that tension came out of that because it came out alongside of these kind of misinterpretations also of critical race theory, anti-racism, and we're seeing diversity, inclusion, justice, and equity. And I think that this is the moment that we are in as a country. And so when you have things like linguistic justice or Black language demands, it falls squarely into, that kind of gap and people being able to use it to say, it's an indoctrination. So I would say that's the pushback. But, if you look across any type of landmark, cases or positionality, anything with the use of Black people's language, you see this happening. And it's an intentional misinterpretation of what's going on. The Oakland Ebonics controversy was another one. The teachers in that school district, again, were recognizing that many Black students were being placed in special education. They were not getting the type of education that they needed. And so they were going to the school district to do something about it, to recognize and to acknowledge that Black students are coming to school with a language that is indeed a language itself, right? We need to take this in consideration. When the media got a hold to it, it misinterpreted that the school was teaching Black kids Ebonics, and it's like you don't have to teach kids Ebonics that already know Ebonics, you know. But this misinterpretation, I think, is what ends up happening, where you see a lot of like hate coming out, you know. And you know, like I say, against anything that I think moving toward Black liberation is met with these kind of controversies. I would say from the academic community, on the other side of it, I can't say that I think that people wrestle with how, and I think that people in academic spaces, my disciplines, you know, they struggle with how, you know, although like I show how and talk about how in the book, I think they're wrestling sometimes with their positionality, and they're wrestling sometimes with the policies and the like gatekeeping measures that are upheld in their own institutions and departments. And so I think that that's the wrestle. But I would say that it's been received well in terms of like I think it's become something that people understand we need to think about it, right? We need to think about what's happening. I will say it's been a conversation, you know, in our discipline. It's always been, but I feel like the kind of discussion has changed in this current moment of how do we talk about, you know, Black language in this 21st century of Black Lives Matter. What does it mean? And I think that linguistic justice has been central, I think, in those kind of conversations. And so that's what I'm seeing. So it's kind of like a both and an end. And I just like understand, you know, that the work that I'm doing and that people, you know, are going to always stand against, you know, Black freedom.
In an earlier response to a question, you mentioned code switching and code meshing mm-hmm. together, which I understand to both be kind of practices of respectability. Could you maybe elaborate on your opinions and positionality on code switching and code meshing, how you define them, if you see any difference?
Yeah, I see a difference from my perspective. So there's some things, the way code switching has been talked about theoretically and scholarly, that does not necessarily reflect what happens in classrooms. So when I'm talking about code switching, I'm talking about what I've observed in terms of teachers' approaches or the way that, you know, Black students have experienced code switching in classrooms. And so code switching, in fact, if we look at Rebecca Wheeler and Rachel Schwartz, where code switching is you turn off and on, you know, your language. Like specifically for them, what they've done in the book is they've thought of Black language as an informal kind of language. And, you know, standard English then is this formal language, which is inaccurate, because black language has formal and informal registers as well. And so not only do they talk about it being a formal and informal language, they also talk about, you know, like the way which language you use should be based on a context, right? So we know audience and purpose and context matter, but you know, the advice that was given in this book is that, you know, when you're in these kind of nice places, you're using standard English, and when you're in these informal or, you know, laid back places, you're using Black language. And it's just like it's inaccurate, right? Like, you know, like a good place is a church or a good place is a wedding, and it's like it's a really invasive way into the way and the kind of policing of the way that Black people use their language. So that's, you know, like I said, the background on that approach. And then in writing, it's like, you know, only one language can exist in the written context at a time, you know. And so how I understand a contrast to that, specifically thinking about how Brashan Ashanti Young talks about code meshing, he believes that multiple languages can exist in a context at the same time. He believes that people naturally code mesh. He believes that, you know, like if you're giving a writing assignment, students should have an option to be able to code mesh, to use both, you know, like whatever we believe is to be an academic variety and, you know, the language that reflects their linguistic background. In this case, we're talking about Black language. So he sees it as, you know, whereas code switching is either or, he sees it as a both and kind of approach. So I think that those are different approaches. And for me, I feel that they're options. I think that students, you know, how we educate should have options to write however they choose to write. Those are only options. I think what we've seen that I find troubling is that code switching becomes the only way, you know, the only way that you can use in class, the only way to academic success. And I think that's troubling, you know, and it's a really like dominant approach, you know, to language education, and it perpetuates linguistic, you know, hierarchies. And so, and linguistic hegemony. And so I think that like I say, you can't tell students to code switch without also providing them with this entire context of how they're using language. And that's where the Black linguistic consciousness raising comes in. Like, you can't tell students to code switch without talking to them about anti-Black linguistic racism. You know, how their language is part of a larger history. You know, like, students should have options to be able to do something different. Ultimately, I believe that students just should have the space to be able to language. Like, we should have linguistic playgrounds where students can practice and try different things, right? Maybe it's something that doesn't exist that's neither code switching or code meshing, right? You know, that like students want to do, you know, with their language in the context of writing. And I just think that we should be able to create those spaces, you know, for students to do that work. But the ultimate thing is that we have to make sure that we're engaging in that Black linguistic consciousness raising, because none of those approaches matter if students don't have the full understanding, you know, of the things that are informing, you know, either of these options. Why are we even talking about code switching in the first place? Why are we talking about code meshing? It's because we know language and power is something that's real. We know that anti-Black linguistic racism is something that's real, you know? And so, like, I don't know why we don't want to give students access, you know, to that. And so that's what linguistic justice does.
Okay, so you mentioned before about talking about Black language in the context of Black Lives Matter in the 21st century. So to situate linguistic justice into a larger context of anti-Black linguistic racism, I feel that in my experience, appropriation of Black culture and people is very common and unacceptable, but typically appropriation of Black hairstyles is usually more easily condemned compared to Black linguistic appropriation, even though excuses have been given for both. So why do you think that is? Does it have to deal with hair being more visible and concrete compared to language being more internal and abstract?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't say what it's because, but for me, it seems like I think we've had a lot of conversation and a lot of very, like, outside of the educational sector around, like, things like hair, you know, or these very visible things that we believe are visible examples of, like, anti-Blackness, right, and how we need to push against it. Whereas I just feel like language has not entered into certain conversations. I think I'm seeing it now. Like, you can see some things in social media that are happening. But for a long time, I feel like the language part was really something solely housed, like, in terms of how we talk about it in, like, these academic spaces. So I think that's part of the issue. Like, we don't connect language to our culture. We don't connect language to racism. You know, I talk about, like, how even in conversations around critical race theory, you know, we could call out racism, we could call out anti-Blackness, but sometimes when language creep into that conversation, I talk about in linguistic justice, it's like, oh no, you got to use the master tools to dismantle the master's house when it comes to language, but everything else we can push against. And so I feel like, you know, there's a need for this discussion around Black language and this identification to, like, enter into the larger public discourse. And I think that hasn't necessarily happened in the ways that we've seen other things. I think, you know, with social media, I'm starting to see people who are, like, on TikTok who are really calling things out, like Black linguistic appropriation. They're maybe not using those terms, but are saying, like, when things get couched as Gen Z language, are specifically identifying, like, no, this is most of the time AAVE, that many people are really publicly talking about, like, the history, you know, of enslavement. Like, I've seen even in People magazine, because sometimes I, like, Google myself, like, to look for specific things, like, Google, like, language, you know, like, language and young children. And, like, People magazine covered, like, some linguistic justice things, and I was cited in that. I was like, oh, okay, you know, okay, People magazine, and they were writing it to parents, you know, what you can do to advocate for your child's language in a class. Or, like, even outside of the U.S. context, like, you know, Black British English, you know, like, there's a lot of conversations from, like, this very critical linguistic justice type of standpoint that's rising, you know, in these other spaces. And I think that those are good things, and I think that that will help us to move where we're able to connect, you know, language to you know, Black culture, the Black experience, anti-Black racism. You know, I think that those type of things will move us further in that direction. But I think it's just, you know, because people don't have the language, you know what I'm saying, to talk about those things, or don't even have the language to name what it is. Like when I talked about in Linguistic Justice, how the young people were trying to figure out, you know, in the moment of Black Lives Matter, like, you know, they're trying to figure out how their language was treated. And they were talking about, like, yeah, it kind of feels like racism, but how could you be racist through your language? And like them coming into understanding, because like I said, there's no kind of theories to name that. And that's why it was important for me to forward anti-Black linguistic racism. I was, you know, reading about, like, even anti-Black racism is something that we're starting to see, like, meaning using that term to talk about racism specifically toward Black people. That's kind of like really new. And I remember when Dumas and Ross wrote their 2016 Black Critical Race Theory piece, it's when I saw, and I may be off, but I saw them talking about anti-Black racism very specifically in their 2016 piece, I believe. And that gave me the language to be able to say, this is it. You know what I mean? It's anti-Black, but a linguistic racism, you know, and to be able to put that out there, name it. I think it gives people language to name their experiences, or language to name something that they are seeing that's happening. And so that's why I think it's important, you know, for us to have theories to name these kind of things, because it gives you a framework for understanding, oh, this is what I'm experiencing, or for saying, this is what this is, right? You know, this is what I am experiencing right now. It's anti-Black linguistic racism. And so I'm just really curious about, you know, like the future of this work, you know, and beyond me, you know, like beyond me, and what people are going to do and how they're going to take it up and, you know, change and transform things.
Now to our final question, could you talk about your current research on developing and implementing an anti-racist medical curriculum and praxis? Are there any core ideas from Linguistic Justice that you feel are applicable to this new research project?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that question. So the work in medical education grew out of an invitation, you know, again, that like... There were some medical doctors who invited me to be part of a project, you know, that they were working on, and they're trying to like move, think about like more broadly, like how do we have an anti-racist medical curriculum? And so outside of my work on Linguistic Justice, I think a lot about like anti-racist pedagogies. And so when they invited me to join this project, which was ended up being through Seattle Children's Hospital, where we were developing a curriculum, piloting a training, you know, and we were going to pilot this kind of training that will begin with the hospital CEOs, and then eventually everyone in the hospital will be trained under it. But in that project, you know, they wanted us to, you know, develop this curriculum that made people aware of racism, but they wanted a specific section on anti-Black racism just because of the complaints and what they were experiencing in the hospital. And so it was more general, right, where they wanted us to look at these, you know, different acts, you know, like things that were happening in a hospital. But for me, being a language scholar, I immediately saw how, you know, some of the examples of anti-Black racism that were happening had a lot to do with the language, right? Or how the perceptions of Black people who communicated in, whether it was like African American English or like some other version of Ebonics, like the hospital had Black immigrants, you know, a lot of visitors who were Black immigrants too. So I saw the language part happening. And so in my conversations, you know, with public health scholars and medical folks, they talk about like how this is a huge intervention, you know, like Linguistic Justice is a huge intervention because we don't talk about how language is a huge part of, you know, the kind of racial health disparities that we see showing up between patient and provider communication. And so there are perceptions that are instantly made about patients based on the way that they speak, right? And those perceptions lead to providers thinking, is this person, you know, understanding, or are they fully equipped, you know, to understand their health profile? You know, do I need to make more decisions for them about their health? How do I invite them? And so there's some, you know, interest in things that are showing up in that way. And so I'm hoping that, you know, this next study that I do is where I look at these patient-provider interactions around language, but not only studying that, getting the testimonies, I think, and the experiences from Black people who are communicating in Black language and how they feel, you know, they have to navigate the healthcare system or the type of experiences that they are having. And where I think linguistic justice can be an intervention, it's what I think it does well in anti-racist Black language pedagogy is it shows a certain kind of awareness, right? It brings an awareness to the language, you know, by, again, looking at people have to understand the histories in order to see it fully as a language. They have to understand this, like, linguistic aspect of it, that it's a language. I think that as much as we shouldn't have to go all the way around the corner to say it is a language, but I think that there's something that comes out of understanding its history and out of understanding, like, the features of the language that I think could shift, like, you know, language ideologies that people have. And so, like, for me, I guess I feel one way of, you know, leading toward transformation and is through education and through teaching and learning. I just feel like, for me, that's the space that I operate in. You know, what is the type of education, the type of curriculum that we need? What is the type of training that we need to make people more aware of what's happening? And I'm not saying that's the only thing that's not going to be the only thing that can solve anti-Black racism at all. But I think that, like, it helps people to become aware, you know, of some of the things that are impacting, you know, their practice.
Thank you for all of your answers. They're very thoughtful. To our listeners, I encourage you to visit clarkforum.org for more information. Once again, on behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you so much for sharing your time and perspective today.
Thank you.